Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 13-59, State versus Garcia. Arguing for the petitioner, Benjamin D. Lowenthal. Arguing for the respondent, Richard K. Minatoya. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, Mr. Lowenthal and Mr. Minatoya. You're both ready to proceed? All right. Mr. Lowenthal, I'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. For you're saving 5 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll give you that warning, and Mr. Minatoya will give you a warning with 5 minutes to go as well. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
This case, or rather this appeal, raises a single issue. It is a question of law, and that question is whether the prosecutor's conduct in this case arose through a breach of the plea agreement. That in itself is really the only question that is before this court. The second issue, which was an issue that was never addressed by the trial court, is what to do in light of the breach. And so this case presents a very clear opportunity, or an opportunity for the court to very, very clearly articulate what does and does not constitute a breach of a plea agreement like this.
Mr. Lowenthal, just so I understand what you're asking for in this case, then, would be to vacate and remand for that consideration of what you characterize as the second issue, if we were to find a breach?
At the very least, that is what we are asking. However, I will submit that the record does show enough for this court to give the remedy of a new trial and reinstatement of constitutional rights. And the main reason why I say that is because throughout the record, it is pretty clear what Mr. Garcia's preference was, which was a reinstatement of his constitutional rights to go to trial. And so I believe on this record, you would have enough, should this court be so inclined, to take that step and simply order a new trial.
You're saying that we should apply the factors in Adams ourselves?
I believe that there's enough in the record for this court to do so, especially given throughout the course of the record as to what Mr. Garcia wanted. So I do believe that the court does have enough to make that step. But the single question, and I believe the threshold question, is whether there was a breach. And I do think that the precedent of Miller, Adams, and Abbott all pretty much show that when you have a term that says the prosecution has agreed to remain silent or to simply not do anything in front of a tribunal that's going to be deciding a sentencing matter, or in this case a minimum term, that's it. They can't do anything.
Well, the plea agreements talked about what happened at the minimum term, correct?
Correct.
Was there anything in the plea agreement that said the prosecutor was not allowed to give input to the pre-sentence report?
There's nothing in the terms of the agreement that addresses that specific point with the PSI.
And would such a plea agreement, if it said the prosecutor could not give input, would such a plea agreement be legal? Would it be legal under our law to say that a prosecutor couldn't give input to the PSI?
I think it would be permissible. I think the parties can negotiate a term like that. I think there has been a case, I believe it was the Adams case, which included the written portion of everything that the prosecutor would have argued at a sentencing hearing. They put in the PSI, and the term of that agreement was something like, you must remain silent at the sentencing hearing.
Okay, that's a different issue, whether they do. I'm asking you a pre-sentence report, and if I read this correctly, the prosecutor was responding to a specific inquiry from the probation department, which the probation department routinely does. It sent a letter to the prosecutor and said, do you have input? And so it was responding to that letter.
I believe that given the terms of the plea agreement, and given where the PSI goes, I think the terms would mean that the prosecution cannot respond.
Okay.
So the question as to whether that's legal, I would submit that it is a permissible plea agreement that can be reached between the parties.
So in your view, the defense and prosecutor can trump the statutes which provide what a pre-sentence report shall do?
I would argue as an analogy to the sentencing hearing, in which the sentencing judge would routinely ask the prosecutor or the defense whether they have anything to say before sentence is imposed. And if there is a plea agreement in which they are not, they've agreed to remain silent, they would simply decline that invitation to give an input. So I do believe it is analogous to that situation.
What if the information provided by the prosecution had been simply factual without the sort of suggestion of it constituting aggravating factors? Would that have been a different case?
I don't believe so, given that it says to remain silent. I believe that that language makes it fairly clear that the prosecution cannot put any input, even if it is simply factual, because facts do matter, and facts can have an influence on a tribunal.
Counsel, I'm not aware of a plea agreement ever saying that the prosecutor cannot or the defendant can't provide input to a plea agreement. I'm asking this again, but it seems to me when we look at the purpose of a pre-sentence report, it seemed to me the whole basis was that there was this belief that because the pre-sentence report was going to the paroling authority, therefore any input was unlawful. And my question to you is, aren't there many other functions of a pre-sentence report?
There are. But
can you tell me some of them?
Some of the functions of the pre-sentence report is to give guidance to the paroling authority in coming up with a minimum term, in having some sort of background or basis on the defendant once they are sentenced and put into the custody of DPS.
And afterwards, for supervising the individual? That's a function of the pre-sentence report?
That's correct. And a lot of those functions are addressed during the PSI interview, and a lot of those assessments are not something that the prosecution normally participates in. And so this specific part of the PSI is about whether the prosecutor's recommendation for a sentence.
So it's not your argument, following up what you said, because, for example, this is going to be considered when it comes up time for parole, correct?
Correct.
And so one of the things that limited the prosecutor was to the minimum term. There was no limitation that the prosecutor couldn't give input on a pre-sentence report that would be utilized later, and it might even be used presumably when it comes time when they're for social services, like when the person's required to undergo sex offender treatment.
That's correct. There is, if I understand correctly, this plea agreement would allow the prosecution to give input at a parole hearing once the minimum term has been set. But because of the role the PSI plays in the minimum term, our position is that it is inappropriate or a breach of the plea agreement to put the written finding before the minimum term. There's nothing stopping, there's nothing stopping the prosecutor from sending this letter when Mr. Garcia would be up for parole once the minimum term had been set.
So following up what you're saying, there's no problem with giving the information to the pre-sentence report, but what the problem is if that information specifically would be looked at in the minimum term. So for example, we don't want to prepare a deficient pre-sentence report because if there's a deficient pre-sentence report that excludes important information from the prosecutor, then when the guy comes through the criminal justice system again and the second judge is looking at it, are we going to have a deficient pre-sentence report because there's some agreement that's been interpreted that the prosecutor doesn't give input?
I think in that situation there would be nothing stopping the prosecutor again in the second case from saying the reason why there's no input in this first one is because of this plea agreement.
Well, there's another approach as well. Since the only problem, it wasn't that the pre-sentence report was flawed. The only problem was whether or not this thing should have been some excising of what was submitted when it went to the HPA.
I think that's the second question, which is upon a finding of the breach, what should be done?
Well, that's assuming there's a breach.
Correct.
And the statute specifically provides the sentencing judge with the authority to excise matters from a pre-sentence report. We have that in the statute.
I believe that once there is a breach found, The question then becomes what to do. And I think the court excising the PSI over the objection primarily of Mr. Garcia and his request for a new trial is really putting step two before step one. I understand that the court has the power to excise it, but the court made a specific finding here there was no breach. And the reason why that's important is because when we get to the second step, we must look at what the preference of the defendant is.
And well, so, I come back to my prior question to you. Is the thing or the aspect of this case which is objectionable from the point of view of what the state did, that in effect it was, rather than responding with factual information, it responded with argument. It said, want to bring out aggravating factors, lengthy list of factors supporting imprisonment, cannot think of a single factor for supporting withholding of a term of imprisonment, talks about the impact, it argues about the impact of the case on the victim or complaining witness. Is that what makes it objectionable, or is it your position that the state could not even provide factual information?
I think because the language of the plea agreement says to remain silent, I think because of that language, I think even a factual recitation of the offense would be a breach of the plea agreement. In this case, we have an argument as well as facts. So our position is that it is a very clear breach.
Suppose this was a separate letter and wasn't included in the pre-sentence report. Would you be arguing breach?
A separate letter being sent to the paroling authority.
Yeah. In other words, because the probation department was the one who put the letter in the PSI. Right?
Yes.
I mean, it could have been forwarded separately.
If it was forwarded and it did reach the paroling authority.
I'm not saying the paroling authority. This only went to the court.
Oh, I see. I would argue then that it's not a breach because it's not going to the paroling authority and it would not be going towards, be used as a tool in determining the minimum term.
So is the breach the probation department inclusion?
No. Well.
And the probation officer is required by statute, right? The probation officer shall engage, investigate any case referred to the probation office or that's been referred by the court. And doesn't the pre-sentence report requirements also require this kind of information to be included?
In this case, we also had a Rule 11 in which the judge had agreed. And it does raise another, I think it does get to the question as to whether the probation as a function of the judiciary is also bound when the judge finds itself to Rule 11. So there's another layer to that aspect as well.
The judge carried through on the Rule 11, did not the judge?
As far as the sentencing, yes. And I point that out because I do think it also shows that the inclusion of this letter in the exhibits is unnecessary as a way of trying to give a recommendation to a judge who had already bound himself to the plea agreement.
Mr. Lowenthal, to be clear, if you could help me, the plea agreement is entered into a Rule 11 approval is obtained from the court, and the agreement is to remain silent. And then the probation office takes over and puts together the pre-sentence report, correct?
Correct.
Okay, when the pre-sentence report is being prepared and you're advising your client, and you do advise your client about the effect of the Rule 11 agreement, then your advice or the advice of defense counsel would be that the defendant should expect the prosecution to maybe write a letter to the judge explaining the reasons why the prosecutor feels that, or shall we say, explaining information that would reflect very poorly on the defendant. Would that be something that you would anticipate would be part of the advice of defense counsel?
I think with an agreement like this, that should not be expected.
All right. And so there has been, if you will, a relationship entered into between the attorney and his client as to this Rule 11 agreement. And can you comment on the extent to which that agreement, understanding between defense counsel and the client, would be affected if it was necessary as a matter of law for the probation office to obtain a statement of facts from the prosecution for purposes of sentencing.
I would say from an advocacy standpoint, when defense counsel, or when an agreement like this is entered, from an advocacy standpoint, the last thing to be determined would be the minimum term before the paroling authority. And so it should be expected that defense counsel will maximize the PSI, or the pre-sentence investigation, to maximize their attempt to get as low a minimum as possible in an agreement like this. And I believe that is the main point of having one of these agreements, because once that happens, and I'm speaking from an advocacy standpoint, defense counsel should not have to anticipate or worry that the prosecution is going to be submitting aggravating factors to be considered at the minimum term hearing. They have agreed to have no input and to not influence the parole board.
Then is it your view that the right to counsel included the right to limit the amount of information that was going to be provided to the probation office for purposes of preparing the pre-sentence report?
I think the pre-sentence report is actually ancillary to an agreement like this one. We all know that the pre-sentence report will be forwarded to the paroling authority. I think that if an agreement like this can be reached, then defense counsel should expect a pre-sentence report that will have, like I said, maximize the efforts to get a low minimum. And then at the hearing, I believe counsel should expect that there be no input from the prosecution, and it would be really up to the parole board and the arguments of counsel.
So your position is the prosecutor would be bound not to put in information. What about you? Are you guys bound one way or the other too? Is this a plea agreement where neither side can provide input? Because the probation officer went down and talked to your client, and your client had every opportunity to give input and declined to.
I believe that the defense would have the right to make arguments in favor of a low minimum.
I see. So we have a plea agreement here that says nothing about it on its face, but it would prohibit the prosecution from giving input, but allow the defense. Let me ask you something further, you said, because one of the things you addressed was the fact that it's the purpose of the plea agreement is to get the least minimum possible. In other words, so that's the ultimate objective. And when we look at plea agreements, we analogize it to contract. Isn't that the pretty well-settled law?
For the most part,
country?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So when we look at a breach, we look at to see whether there's a material breach. And when we look at a material breach, we look to determine whether the objective of the plea agreement was frustrated. And in this case, the objective of the plea agreement was not in any way frustrated. There's no material breach that occurred.
I believe this is probably one of the few places in which plea agreements in criminal cases would have to depart with contract law. Because if you look at it from a contract law perspective, as far as the second question as to the remedy, one could either give the defendant the benefit of the bargain, which is what Judge Bisson wanted to do here, or put the parties in a place as if the agreement was never reached, if we're looking at it from a contract perspective. And I believe the cases make it clear that the reason why we give preference to what the defendant wants in the event of a breach is because we are talking about that individual defendant's constitutional rights. So I think in this particular place, there is a departure from contract law.
But I understand with remedy, but I'm talking about breach. In order to determine whether there's a breach, we have to find, it can't be something Manini or something like that. I mean, for example, let me just follow up. Because your client moved to withdraw the plea long before this pre-sentence report came out, right?
I believe so.
Okay, very early on, moved to withdraw. And that's sort of what happened in this case, too. I mean, neither side was able to, in a sense, frustrate the plea agreement. Both sides did something that could be characterized as taking actions that maybe were inconsistent, theoretically, but neither of them frustrated the objective, and therefore, there's no material breach.
I would posit that there was a material breach, because when we look at what a breach is, we have to examine the conduct. And in almost every case we're dealing with an allegation that the prosecution had breached it, So when we look at that, we have to examine what is the conduct, not necessarily the result of the conduct. And so when we look at solely the conduct here, we have a prosecutor who had submitted the letter and the exhibits that is on its way to the paroling authority that's going to use that as a tool to determine the minimum term. So in that sense, we do submit that it's a material breach.
So it's actually the, but you acknowledge that the report had gone separately, so it was actually the probation officer's inclusion that you're calling a material breach.
If we're going to zero in on what the prosecutor's conduct would be, it would be submitting the materials to the probation officer, knowing full well that that was on, going to be included in the PSI. But for the filing of the motion, it would have gone to the paroling authority. And I know there's a lot of back and forth between the trial court and trial counsel about attempted breach and that, so to speak. But because of the motion, that was the only reason why it did not make it to the paroling authority.
Mr. Lowenthal, your discussion with Justice Pollack about the possibility of a remedy having been applied here by the trial judge, that is action taken by Judge Bisson that would mean there wasn't a breach because the information didn't get to the paroling authority. The notion that there, under that analysis, is not a breach, I wanted to ask you to consider in light of the relationship between defense counsel and the defendant. You said conduct was an issue that was significant to look at in terms of determining whether there was a violation of the plea agreement. And that conduct, in other words, action taken by the prosecutor that is contrary to the plea agreement, but nonetheless may not have created an injury from the point of view of the information getting to the paroling authority, does that action and that conduct create a have an effect on the attorney-client relationship?
I think it does. When I sit back and think about what happened here, we have a situation. I mean, if we look at the ICA's opinion and the ruling by the trial court judge, this would encourage defense counsel to do nothing. It would mean that it would be better to not file a motion to withdraw the no contest plea, allow the letter to make its way to the paroling authority, and by then try to raise it there. And it creates all kinds of procedural problems. It creates questions of the effectiveness of counsel. If counsel knows this letter's there.
Mr. Lowenthal, are you arguing that defense counsel should drop their... It would violate professional ethics not to zealously represent your client, so to argue that you should allow this. I mean, what occurred was, at least one way to look at this is all the harm was rectified. All the potential harm was rectified. No breach occurred. So, and it happened because of zealous representation.
That's right. I'm saying from this point forward, if this is not a breach and agreements like this go forward, it raises a question as to what defense counsel must do. If we hold there's no breach, or if we find there's no breach from this point forward, it raises a serious question as to what would happen if this were to come up again. Does defense counsel file a motion? Well, knowing full well that it's not a breach until it reaches the paroling authority, then in that case there'd be no grounds to file a motion.
But why would you want to do that if your goal is to effectuate the plea agreement that you, the only reason, okay, yeah. Go ahead.
Why would you want to do it? If your goal, presumably, is to have parties comply with the plea agreement, not to get your client off or not to have him in trial, right? Isn't the goal to have, so why would you wait till after the deed is done? Wouldn't your goal be as counsel to effectuate the terms of the plea agreement?
Yes, and I guess what I guess I'm not making myself clear is that what I'm trying to say is that if we find that this isn't a breach, then in the future, I would anticipate that would be the first argument of the prosecution should this situation happen and you try to file the motion prior to sentencing. And they come back and say, well, this isn't a breach because it hasn't reached the paroling authority yet. It becomes a circular argument. That's all I'm trying to point out.
Well, Mr. Lowenthal, aren't there institutional interests in the integrity of the system beyond just the individual interests of the defendant in the case? In other words, in our Miller decision, you know, we cited the Supreme Court's decision in Santabello that rejected the notion that even though a breach of a plea agreement, the trial judge had taken the position it didn't affect his determination of sentence at all. That was rejected, and we cited that with approval and said, breach of a plea agreement, regardless of whether the breach affected the sentencing decision, requires relief. It is a breach in and of itself that is the injustice. So I guess the question would be, are there institutional interests that are implicated solely by the conduct of the government, whether or not, irregardless of whether, because of the intervention in this case by the court, that favorably or fortunately kept the breach from having a negative effect on the defendant? Nevertheless, are there implications for the system that would justify relief?
I would say yes, and the reason why is because if I understand the question.
My question is, does there have to be prejudice? And if not, why not?
Absolutely not. I don't think you need to have prejudice. I think the Miller case makes that fairly clear. I think it's because one of the key aspects is preserving the integrity of the judicial system as a whole, and part of that, at this day and age, is plea agreements. We can't have a functional criminal justice system without plea agreements, and if there is a breach, then that needs to be addressed first, and the question of remedy and looking at prejudice is a secondary issue. So for the first question as to whether there is a breach, I believe that it is a very clear legal issue. Once we move on to what the remedy should be, that's where we look at factors and that sort of thing.
Getting back to the Chief Justice's initial question as to, you know, what is it because the letters were argumentative that made it, in your view, a breach? In other words, what if, well, I can't remember who gets the information regarding priors, but the PSI needs to contain if a defendant has priors. If the prosecutor had provided that kind of information and that had gone to the HPA, would that still have been a breach? I mean, what about factual information that is required to be contained within a PSI?
The factual information required to be in a PSI, fortunately, comes from places other than the prosecutor's office. And so my position is, when the prosecutor is responding to an inquiry and providing facts that are in addition to whatever is required.
So the probation officer never gets factual information from the prosecutor. Just gets the police report from the police, not from the prosecutor.
I'm not sure where.
Gets witness statements from the police, not through the prosecutor. Directly contacts the police department?
I'm not sure where they get the police reports or where they get the prior information or the information of any prior record. I guess if we do need to make a distinction, if there are facts that are in addition to whatever it is required, such as things other than the police reports and priors, then that would be communication by the prosecutor's office that I think steps out of bounds of what they've agreed to do.
So your argument is that the prosecutor can't give any facts that aren't already contained or aren't already in possession of the prosecutor? I mean, that aren't already in possession of the probation officer.
I would submit yes. I'm not too sure. As I stand here today, I'm not sure where the probation officer gets police reports. And
so if the victim is on the mainland and the PSI has to contain a victim witness statement, victim impact statement, the probation officer can't contact the prosecutor to find out where the victim is, get the address, how to contact that victim?
That is very similar to the, I believe it's United States v. Cook, which was cited by the Supreme Court, in which the prosecutor didn't provide any factual assertions, but simply assisted the probation officer in finding aggravating factors, in which the Seventh Circuit found a breach. I believe, yes, that would be a breach in this case.
Even though our PSI statute, I think, requires a probation officer to get the victim's statement or input.
And to follow that up, the prosecutor had a victim impact letter that was theoretically was required to be included.
That's correct, and I still stand by this plea agreement in which if the prosecutor agrees with the defense to remain silent, the prosecutor cannot be engaging in conduct that would show up in a PSI on its way to the paroling authority.
And I still think that there's an argument that any such plea agreement that would restrict the prosecutor from following our statutes and providing input would be very dubious.
Just as a last point, then, and I see that my time, I'm eating into my rebuttal time. In a situation like that, I do see your point, Justice Pollack, but I think when we look at what was actually submitted in this case, it goes well beyond that. So I can...
How is breach defined?
There's no way that it is... The breach is not defined necessarily.
No, not the breach. What's the legal definition of breach under contract law?
I believe it's something to the effect of engaging in conduct that you promise not to do in a case like this. I think that would probably be the most simple way to state it for this case.
So an attempted breach is a breach?
I would say for this purpose, yes. It's not all that different than an offense and the attempted commission of an offense.
Maybe we should treat it the same. Here's one definition from our case law. The breach simply did not defeat the object of the parties in making the agreement. We look to the contract as a whole to shed light on the intent of the parties in entering. This was in a lease. Whether it cut to the root. In other words, whether it prevented the objective of the two parties from being achieved. And in this case, it doesn't seem to me, at least under one argument, is the HPA was not able to fulfill what the parties had intended.
Well, that, let's hear from Mr. Minutoya.
Thank you.
And I will give you some rebuttal time.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. May it please the court. This is not an ideal situation. We're clear about that. We acknowledge that. But looking at the conduct of the prosecutor, there's no guarantee that that letter was going to go to the Hawaii Paroling Authority as an attachment to the PSI.
Do you think it was a breach? The submission of the letter?
Me personally, I wouldn't have done it like that. But
does it meet the legal definition of breach? Clearly, it was an attempted breach.
I would say not. I would agree that it is an attempt at a breach, but the key difference between this case and the case law that exists, the three cases, the court was the intermediate step. You know, the other cases, it went probation court, right, sentencing court, and, you know, there's no distinction between that, but in our case, it was the intermediate step of the court, and the court corrected what it deemed to be that
so absent the court correcting it, there would have been a breach, in your view? So if the court had, if people were just asleep at the switch and let the PSI go through, would that have been a breach?
If that letter had gotten into the hands of the HPA, I would take the position, yes, that would be a breach.
Well, then what is Mr. Lowenthal's scenario? What is the defense attorney to do then? If it's clear that if it doesn't get to the HPA, it's not a breach.
Well, the problem with that is you have the HPA, by the attorney not doing that and letting that material through, you know, it will prejudice the attorney's client. With the courts, you have different judges that can, you know, that you can transfer the case to, but with the HPA, you have the HPA. I mean, at that point, I think that'll be the detriment to the attorney's client not to make an objection prior to that.
Well, Mr. Minutoya, then what would you suggest, if anything, would be a remedial action that should be taken, presumably by the trial court, where the prosecutor takes action that is a fundamental breach, unless the court intervenes. So when it is now on the, if you will, on the procedural posture of being headed towards the paroling authority in a manner that would be in direct contradiction of the agreement, and the judge has to step in and correct the situation, is there any remedy available to the defense?
But the court stepped in, it'll be similar to the situation where it would be corrected and there's a remedy.
Now, the remedy essentially is that the judge has fixed the situation.
That's correct.
All right.
Now, if it doesn't get caught and it gets through, then I think we fall back on the
option of the defendant. Let me ask you, in that regard, then, your view about what the Chief Justice had referred to as an institutional concern in this case. It's expressed in Miller. In other words, the degree to which prejudice should be considered in this context and the degree to which this should be a purely contractual analysis from the point of view of a civil legal perspective. In the circumstance that the defendant finds him or herself in where there is an agreement reached and the court acknowledges that there is a potential breach. The defendant's entered into this agreement with defense counsel and now sees that the prosecution has taken action contrary to what the defendant thought was fair in a manner in which the court, I think, makes, a relatively straightforward endorsement of the idea it's not fair by finding there could be a potential breach. Does that, from an institutional point of view, seem to create any difficulty with respect to the continuing proceedings from the point of view of the defendant being able to trust, one, the attorney who said this agreement is going to proceed in a certain manner and the attorney's advice presumably was shown to be incorrect, and secondly, a defendant seeing that a judge has seen conduct by the prosecution that is in violation of an agreement that the judge has been a party to through the Rule 11 agreement, and the judge is not permitting the defendant to then say, I don't trust the system. I don't trust what's going to happen when I get to the paroling authority. I want my trial. Now I would like my trial. Is there an institutional concern there, notwithstanding the fact that maybe the defendant's wrong, and maybe everything's going to be fair, and maybe he can depend on the prosecution when the paroling authority convenes? And he should depend on the prosecution, although he may not feel that way. He should depend on the good faith of the prosecution to not violate once they get to the paroling authority.
Well, it's not an ideal situation, but I think...
Can you see that there could be an institutional concern from the point of view of the manner in which the defendant is now going to proceed in the case?
There would be, but it's not atypical to... I mean, it's not typical just only to that situation. I mean, the defendant can also take the position, I was found guilty and I don't trust the system. I mean,
but this is a pre-sentencing plea, right?
That's correct.
Okay, with motion to withdraw the plea, I'm sorry. And in State versus Adams, we said that a liberal approach should be taken to withdrawal of plea before sentencing. It should be granted if defendant is presented a fair and just reason and the state has not relied to its detriment. There was no argument made below that the state had suffered detrimental reliance in regards to his plea that I recall, was there?
Not to my recollection either.
So why is it not a fair and just reason for the defendant to say, you didn't follow through on your promise? You promised you weren't going to affect you weren't going to affect the decision at the HPA. You took actions which, but for intervention of the judge, would have affected those proceedings. As Justice Wilson said, why isn't the defendant's loss of confidence in the process a fair and just reason?
The distinction is that when the defendant made the agreement said the prosecution will remain silent at the HPA. Now, whether or not you take that letter as written to the probation office as a breach or not, I think it depends upon whether the prosecutor knew or is it the regular practice to always include the letter from the prosecution as part of the PSI. We can't say that because many times it's not. So,
what about the information from the letter? Was the information from the letter included in the PSI? There was zero mitigating factors and 18 aggravating factors found in that PSI, correct?
PSI was sealed, so I don't have any recollection of what it contained, but again, it was sealed, a new PSI was done, and a new probation officer was assigned to prepare the new PSI.
But I come back to my question. Why isn't, if it's a liberal standard and the question is whether the defendant has presented a fair and just reason, why is it not a fair and just reason that the government has engaged in conduct which, but for the intervention of the court, would have affected the Hawaii Paroling Authority's decision contrary to the agreement?
Well, again, it comes back to the distinction of, or the issue of, whether or not it was clear that the letter would be included as an attachment to the PSI or not, because the agreement solely stated that the prosecution would remain silent before the HPA.
Did you make that argument in the trial, in the circuit court, or family court, I'm sorry? Circuit court, pardon me.
You know, it appears from what I've reviewed that the whole issue revolved around trying to find a remedy for it. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, like some agreements that were made off the record, unfortunately, you know, at some point, I think parties and the lower court should be reminded that important aspects of plea agreements such as these should be put on the record and not as part of an off-the-record discussion. So, you know, unfortunately, I can't refer to discussions that were represented to me as being made at the bench, but not put on the record.
Do you agree with Mr. Lowenthal's position that the prosecutor, based on this plea agreement, was precluded from submitting information to the probation office? That's his argument.
Again, that's the issue of whether or not the prosecutor would know that information would be...
Any information, I think, is the question. The information along the lines of what has been discussed here today. Priors, victim information.
I think information without argument should be permitted.
And in fact, there are many plea agreements in which it is specifically stated that the state, the prosecutor, will not take a position at sentencing, correct?
That's correct.
This is a different plea agreement. It's at the minimum.
And that's why, you know, we're taking the position as it's one step removed, because there's an intermediate step of the sentencing and the court between probation and...
Doesn't that envision that the prosecutor would provide some information at least to the probation officer, since there are plea agreements in which the prosecutors, the state agrees not to take a position at sentencing, to the parole authority.
Again, the plea agreement specifically stated that the state will remain silent before the paroling authority. So, mm-hmm.
And in fact, to follow up with Justice McKenna said, I think it was agreed to if the contents of the letter had been argued at sentencing, there wouldn't have been a problem.
That's correct.
So it's not even the genre of the information that's in the report. It's the fact that somebody stuck it in the PSI, that we're here. And that, of course, contemplates that we have a judge who's part of this plea agreement, who's bound himself, and therefore is there to rectify any situation.
That's our position, that it was corrected. And the HPA never received or never saw any of this. The thing is, with these cases that involve sentencing, the court did see it because it came up before the court. In this case, the entity that the state agreed to remain silent before never, would not have any inkling of this taking place. And based on that, the prejudice is not there as far as the prejudice suffered by the petitioner.
So you'd say there's no institutional interests in the integrity of the system that are relevant?
There is, and I think that was addressed by the court remedying the situation, striking and sealing the PSI, ordering a new PSI done by a different probation officer. It's like when this court reverses or vacates and remands a case for resentencing, and they say resentencing before a different judge. So it's a clean slate all over again.
But is there no, so there's no consequence to the government having engaged in conduct that you yourself have said you wouldn't have engaged in? No consequence. As long as the judge stepped in, that's it, you get a free pass? Or are there sometimes, are there at least sometimes potential consequences or an institutional interest in ensuring that the system is one that has integrity and that the promises made by the government will be followed through on?
I think there may be potential potential consequences, both employment-wise. Also, the court, if deemed bad enough, the court can issue sanctions against counsel for doing
and
that.
And if the court had found this intentional, for example, if this was intentional conduct to try to breach this by getting this into the PSI, proper remedy or proper course, I think, by the court would have been to refer this to the disciplinary council.
That's correct.
So there are sanctions. It's just it's a whole different issue whether there was a breach.
And
Mr. Minotauri, yes. If you could help me following through with this idea of the judge being in the role to correct violations by either party, but in this case, I guess it's the prosecution, being in the role to correct. Assuming that we didn't have defense counsel quite as vigilant and not in a conscious way, as we have discussed previously, defense counsel maybe consciously deciding not to raise it until the time of the paroling authority. But let's assume that for whatever reason, there is not an issue raised until it gets to the paroling authority, and then the information is provided to the paroling authority in a way that's clearly in violation of the plea agreement. However you want to characterize that, maybe the prosecutor appears independently and directly violates the plea agreement by directly providing the information. Then what? At that point, the sentencing's taken place. Defendant's been incarcerated for a while. The defendant appears before the paroling authority. There's a violation of the plea agreement. And is it at that point that we would agree there's a breach? Under those circumstances, would we agree there's a breach?
Under those facts, yes.
Okay. And then what is the remedy available to the defendant at that time?
According to the case law, the remedy would be, again, resentencing and going through the whole minimum term setting hearing.
Resentencing, or would he be able to withdraw his plea?
It's a choice, according to the case law, it's a choice by the defendant whether it's to have resentencing and go through that process again, or to withdraw the plea.
So in a sense, this might be something of an exception to the principle that was raised by the Chief Justice, that you apply a liberal standard, because perhaps we would excuse in this case the fact that there wasn't brought up prior to the time of sentencing, because defense counsel could then at that point say, well, I didn't want to raise it before it got to the paroling authority, and please apply, or it would be therefore only correct to apply the more liberal standard in terms of withdrawal of the plea. And in terms of, I guess you could say, the administration of justice in an efficient way, the conservation of judicial resources, is that, you think, the most efficient way to deal with this circumstance?
I think in this circumstance where it was caught and it was corrected, I think you mentioned judicial economy. That's what should apply here. I think in the case where it wasn't caught and got through and got to the paroling authority, then, I mean, the law is clear that the defendant has those remedies, and the choice of the defendant should be considered in granting whatever remedy is afforded to the defendant.
So well, the defendant wanted to, the defendant's end goal is to withdraw his plea. It would behoove if we say there's no breach in a circumstance like this, it would behoove a defense attorney just to not do anything until again, it got to HPA. Separate apart from rules of professional responsibility, they have to, you know, try and represent their client zealously. Maybe part of that is his end game is he wants to go to trial. So if we find that there's no breach in this case,
I think
Mr. Lowenthal's argument is,
you're referring to his argument, and to a certain extent that's true. You know, defense attorney could remain silent. The question is now, back to what I stated earlier, that if that information gets through to the paroling authority, does that prejudice the defendant later if he's convicted after withdrawing his plea and having to go before the HPA again. And that's something I guess defense counsel would have to weigh, in making his or her decision in advising the client.
So we have that hypothetical. We have to assume first that the prosecutor basically knew this was going to go in, so therefore it was professional misconduct, and then we have to have a defense attorney who also is going to engage in professional misconduct by not zealously representing the defendant in order to get this scenario of it occurring and it suddenly appearing, nobody knowing, and it appears at the minimum term, which lawyers are present at, and then it becomes. So if that does occur, there is a remedy from a post-conviction relief.
If all of those stars align,
yes.
That's correct.
But if they waited until the hearing, wouldn't it be a Rule 40 proceeding and it would be a manifest injustice standard?
It would be subject to a Rule 40 proceeding. Whether, you know, what our position would be at that point, I don't know, because I don't know what the exact facts would be and what kinds of representations or information got out to the HPA. But yes, it would be subject to a Rule 40. So, you know, as far as our position is concerned, you know, again, we admit and we agree that it's not an ideal situation that occurred, but given the fact that the remedy was available and a remedy was instituted in this case, and thereby resulting in no prejudice to the petitioner, that the ICA's decision should be affirmed.
Do you think Adams, the court should do an Adams analysis, the trial court?
The thing about these cases, again, is the fact that the trial court is the intermediate step. And so I guess the broad brush of Adams doesn't necessarily apply because, you know, in this case, in Adams, it went straight to the probation officer, and, you know, that's just part of the PSI to go to the court. In our case, because there's the court as the, I would say, the traffic cop in this case, which is, I guess, what occurred, it's a different situation.
But in other words, the trial court here didn't even get to the Adams analysis. It concluded there was no breach because of the action it took. If we were to conclude that there was a breach, is it your view that then it would be appropriate to send this case back to the trial court to assess the factors that Adams says, which is considerable weight to the choice of the defendant, timeliness of the motion, extent of the breach, prejudice to the parties, and what alternative will best serve the ends of justice? So some of the things that we've been talking about here today would be relevant in that discussion, but it would also be taken into account in the broader context of most notably the defendant's desire to withdraw his plea.
That's correct. If this court decides that a breach did occur, then under Adams, those remedies would be should be applied to the defendant.
Those factors.
Those factors, that's correct. If there are no further questions, I've concluded my argument.
Thank you very much,
Thank
Mr.
Very
Montoya.
Much.
Mr. Lowenthal, we'll give you a couple minutes to wrap up.
Thank you. I'll just address some of the points that was raised by Mr. Montoya. I think it's very important to note that we've been talking about this hypothetical as to what would have happened if the motion was never filed and this initial PSI made its way to the paroling authority in front of, at the minimum term hearing. It would create a situation in which the defendant is, basically, if the defendant wants to correct the situation, would have to file a Rule 40 petition. And I believe Justice Wilson pointed out, what is the efficiency of that? By making this distinction between attempted breaches and actual breaches, it really does become an inefficient way of addressing this. There's no reason to not address it while the court still has jurisdiction. And while the court can do something about it instead of waiting for a Rule 40, I point out From a practical standpoint, in a lot of cases, you get a court-appointed counsel who would raise the issue at a minimum term hearing, and that would be the end of it. And then it would be up to the defendant by him or herself to file one of these pro se Rule 40 petitions and hope that a new counsel is appointed.
Mr. Lowenthal, it seemed to argue that the difference between attempted breach and breach is a distinction without a difference, but different standards apply. I mean, if there's an actual breach, it seems like the defendant really can choose what his options are. You should allow a withdrawal, but if there's an attempted breach, that may not be so. So there is a huge difference between the two.
I think the distinction as to the defendant's choice becoming a paramount consideration is whether the motion was timely filed, I think, is the distinction. And I think that was the distinction argued below. When I say it is a distinction without difference, I say that because when we must look at the conduct of the prosecution of the person who did the breach. And so just because it did not necessarily make its way to the paroling authority to have an effect and to create the prejudice doesn't mean that the breach didn't happen. And so
Did your client breach the plea agreement when your client tried to withdraw the plea from the plea agreement very early on? Because there was two motions to withdraw.
Correct.
Did your client breach the plea agreement?
No, because the client, or Mr. Garcia, agreed to 20 years prison in exchange for exchange for the prosecutor to remain silent.
Tried to withdraw his plea almost right afterwards.
Right. I believe that was another issue that was...
Well, he said it wasn't knowing and voluntary. You know, he was somehow coerced or something.
Right. And
does that violate the plea agreement? Or is that an attempted breach, just like arguably what occurred here?
I don't believe it was a breach if one of the issues would be whether they understood what was happening throughout the course of reaching the agreement. I think that's separate from conduct in which they've agreed to be bound by. And just going back to the issue as to...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the set of circumstances that you just described that have occurred in, I think you said there was a distinction without a difference, and I wanted to get back to this idea of whatever you call the breach, whether it's an attempted breach or one that's less significant than a full breach, but something occurred prior to sentencing that became controversial to the point where the judge had to intervene. Now, when you apply the liberal standard that applies for request to withdraw a plea and consider the array of reasons why a defendant often will want to withdraw a plea, in that context, how would you compare this kind of justification, that is justification where there's been a finding that the prosecutor acted inconsistent with the plea agreement, maybe not a full breach, whatever you want to call it. How would you compare that to the normal reason that defendants give to withdraw their pleas prior to the time of sentencing?
When a motion is filed prior to sentencing, the standard that is given is that liberal standard, which would mean that the defendant must show a fair and just reason for withdrawing the plea. Once it's raised after sentencing, the standard becomes...
Well, prior to sentencing, the sort of factual scenario that you have encountered in which defendants have been allowed to withdraw their plea, I mean, is that where maybe they've decided that they didn't understand their attorney's advice? Or, I mean, what kind of circumstances would you say would constitute a basis for the withdrawal of the plea normally?
I would say that there are many different reasons defendants would raise to withdraw the plea agreement and reinstate their jury trial rights. I would say that when one of the reasons is a breach of a plea agreement, that is a significantly more severe, that reason to withdraw a plea based on a breach of a plea agreement is kind of a class unto itself as opposed to claims of not understanding what was going on in reaching the agreement or some change in circumstances that they want to get out of the plea agreement. It is different because it involves not, maybe it doesn't involve the relationship between counsel and the defendant and that sort of thing. It becomes something that affects the whole reason for entering the plea in the first place.
This is a little bit different than the issue raised on appeal, because as you started, the question was, did the conduct arise to a breach? I think that's how you stated it.
Correct.
Your application says, did the conduct here, was it a breach of the promise to stand silent? What we're arguing now was, did the court abuse its discretion in denying the motion to withdraw plea because fair and just reasons were presented? It seems a slightly different focus.
Right. I'll just close on a related point to that, is that the reason why I believe it's important to divide these into two separate questions is, once a breach is found at this juncture, and once it's raised at this juncture prior to sentencing, then the preference of the defendant, I believe that point was conceded by the prosecution, must be taken into consideration. The reason why it wasn't taken into consideration here was because of our position is the erroneous finding that this was not a breach. When we measure breach in a criminal case by the conduct of the prosecutor, it becomes fairly clear. And I just want to point out one last thing on the record, is that at the beginning of the hearing on the motion to withdraw, the parties agreed to the fact that the PSI report gets forwarded to the HPA and that it is available for the HPA to consider as part of fashioning a minimum term. And so with that in place, there is enough in the record to show that it is significant. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both of our counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.